rising above the Arc de Triomphe.
A majestic presence has towered over Paris for more than 130 years.
The Eiffel Tower, with the city stretching into the distance.
A symbol of progress and of breaking boundaries, France's Iron Lady is a global icon. In 1889, Gustave Eiffel achieved the impossible. The dream of every engineer, to build the tallest tower in the world.
An animation of a man working on the Eiffel Tower.
In the heart of Paris, he raised this 7,300-ton iron colossus in just 2 years, 2 months, and 5 days. But this tower could not have existed without the engineering innovations of the three preceding decades and Gustave Eiffel's other work found all over the world. From the bridges of Vietnam to the sweeping Galabee Viaduct, Bordeaux's rivers, to the secrets of New York's Statue of Liberty, the Eiffel Tower is the crowning glory of a life spent pushing back limits. What challenges, both human and technical, did Eiffel and his engineers face with such a massive project? And how did his scientific research help Eiffel save the tower from destruction?
Paris at dusk.
This is the epic story of France's Iron Lady.
Eiffel Tower, building the impossible. A timeline at March 31, 1889. People are on the tower.
On the 31st of March, 1889, Gustave Eiffel refused to allow anyone else to unfurl the French flag at the top of his tower. Aged nearly 60, he faced the ever-changing winds of an icy winter to mark the completion of his greatest masterpiece, 300 meters over Paris.
An animation of Eiffel standing at the top of the tower and the unfurled flag. A steam train.
The Eiffel Tower was born out of the Industrial Revolution. The age of iron and coal. The plentiful supply of coal in Great Britain, where everything started at the end of the 18th century, changed the world. Along with revolutionary inventions like the steam engine, the railway, and the steel industry. One foundation technology of the Industrial Revolution was a type of wrought iron called puddled iron. Strong yet flexible, it was obtained by melting iron ore and introducing oxygen until it was decarbonized. In the 1850s, the production of puddled iron boomed with the mechanization of the blast furnace. In France, a flurry of forges and metal construction companies emerged. One of these firms was founded in 1864 by the 32-year-old engineer Gustave Eiffel.
Eiffel devised his own construction language, borrowing techniques whose main elements were the truss and the St. Andrew's cross, all assembled by rivets. This allowed him to design lighter openwork constructions. These techniques allowed him to build structures which broke records for length, height and reach. And that's what would allow him to embark on conquering the world.
De porter. Et c'est ça qui va lui permettre de partir à la conquête du monde.
Since the beginning of the 19th century, architects had dreamed of exceeding the Gothic cathedrals and the Egyptian pyramids. Two projects for 300-meter-high towers had emerged in England and the United States, but neither was completed. Two prominent engineers from the Eiffel Company, Émile Nouguier and Maurice Kirkland, were also tempted by the idea of building a 300-meter tower. But how to go about it? Using the hallmark iron construction techniques of the Eiffel Company, Kirkland and Nouguier came up with a pylon design. Eiffel was not impressed. For art historian Darcy Grimaldo Grigsby, the yearning for the gigantic fits the historical context of the 19th century.
rise of capitalism, rise of empire, rise of nationalist rivalries, all of that feeds the kind of competition to prove one's modernity, efficiency, and capacity to astonish people with the surprises of things like the Eiffel Tower.
An animated sketch design.
It was the in-house architect, Stéphane Sauvestre, who won Eiffel over to the project. Gracing the pylon with decorative arches and adding platforms to welcome the public. He transformed the unattractive pylon into an elegant monument. Eiffel saw that a revolutionary tower could be the main attraction of the 1889 World's Fair in Paris and committed himself to the project. A fabulous 300-meter iron tower from which people could admire the city of Paris. The Eiffel Tower project was born. The tower would be higher than Notre Dame, the pyramids of Egypt, and almost twice as high as the Washington Monument, which held the world record at 169 meters. Many feared that at 300 meters, the wind would be destructive. How would the engineers ensure that their tower could withstand high winds? Gustave Eiffel built this facility in Paris towards the end of his life, an aerodynamics laboratory which is still in use. This is where Benoît Romain, an expert in structural mechanics, is comparing the effect of wind on models of the Eiffel Tower and a tower with straight sides.
Benoît switches on a large fan in a wind tunnel, then watches the simplified model of the Eiffel Tower he's placed there next to a straight tower. Here we can clearly see that the straight tower is leaning much more than the Eiffel Tower.
Why is the Eiffel Tower model much better at resisting wind than the other model?
In the case of the straight tower, the wind force is perpendicular to the structure and bends it. For the Eiffel Tower, the wind pushes this way, so it's balanced by a push on one leg and a pull on the other. These two forces balance the wind. The wind exerts force along the Eiffel Tower's height, so you have to apply this triangle principle from the top to the bottom. This led to the shape of the Eiffel Tower. It's the best shape to withstand the wind. It's a perfect solution. Reflections of a metal bridge in water.
One of Eiffel's most impressive earlier achievements is this magnificent railway bridge in Auvergne in central France. The Garrabie Viaduct was opened in 1884, just as the project for the Eiffel Tower was being conceived.
Huge red girders.
Standing 120 meters above the Truyère River, it connects the two sides of the valley with a parabolic arch of unprecedented length. 165 meters, a record for the time. Patricia Van Rocher is an expert in the history of the bridge. The metallic structure is a fabulous web-like arrangement of iron beams.
For the Garrabie Viaduct, the three main metal elements are obviously the arch, the key part, then the piers on either sides of the arch, and finally the metal deck.
For Eiffel and his engineers, every bridge was a chance to introduce technical improvements. A parabolic shape would be better able to resist the forces produced by heavy trains. The organizational expertise needed on site testifies to the technical know-how and talent of Eiffel's company.
To build this viaduct, Eiffel demonstrated pure daring. He used a new technique called cantilevering, in which the arch and deck are built from both banks at the same time. The middle-aged, fair-haired man faces a large animation. The central part of the bridge is completed by using the side piers as support points. A system of cables holds the two arches in place as they project into the void 120 meters above the river. This technique demands extreme precision in both the manufacture and the assembly of the elements, because the rivet holes have to align perfectly when they are joined together. Eiffel himself said that they achieved this with an almost mathematical precision.
The perfectly mastered completion of this civil engineering work to worldwide admiration was key to the success of the 300-meter tower project.
On the timeline, 1884, June.
With the Garrabi Viaduct works behind them, the Eiffel team could now focus on building the highest monument in the world. In June 1884, Eiffel, Koechlin, Nouguier and Sauvestre exhibited a model at the Decorative Arts Exhibition.
An animation shows the men looking at the model.
Building a needle in the heart of Paris caught the imagination of the French Minister of Trade, Édouard Lecroy, who was looking for a revolutionary idea to boost the forthcoming World's Fair in 1889.
Gustave Eiffel biographer Michel Carmener. Lecroix was an adventurer who took part in the Commune uprising of 1871. He was someone with a very remarkable personality. He was looking for something to jazz up the 1889 World's Fair.
What better choice than a record-breaking monument? The publicity for Paris and the very young Third Republic would be global. The 300-meter tower would be topped by a beacon. Like another monument intended to enlighten the world, which also owes a lot to Eiffel's genius.
The timeline, a row of dots, slides onwards to 1879.
In 1879, Gustave Eiffel was involved in the construction of a remarkable work, Liberty Enlightening the World, which would later become the Statue of Liberty. The sculpture, by Auguste Bartholdi, was a gift from the Republic of France to the American people to mark the centenary of their independence. The tallest statue in the world at 92 meters, including its pedestal, was another artistic and technical challenge on an unprecedented scale.
What Eiffel proposed was a simple iron pylon, like those you see on his bridges, four box girders at each corner and a cross bracing for stability. A lighter extension with the same structure supports the arm, which holds a torch, symbolizing the light of progress. The Eiffel engineers, and Koechlin in particular, who did the calculations, also devised a secondary internal skeleton holding flexible bars to receive the thin copper skin of the statue. Instead of looking for simple strength, they opted for flexibility. In other words, for the strategy of the reed rather than that of the oak.
The statue and its structure crossed the Atlantic in 210 special crates. Sited at the entrance of New York Harbor, it would become an undisputed symbol of the city. It is 6 a.m. Before opening to the 20,000 daily visitors, ranger Matthew Hoosh climbs up into the heart of the statue. This 162-step staircase gives an insight into Eiffel's structure. The similarities with the tower are clear.
What's most impressive about the interior of the Statue of Liberty is how all of this iron and steel works together to hold her over 300 feet above New York Harbor, over 100 years of wind and rain. She still stands because of this interior structure. The inside of the Statue of Liberty can be a disorienting place. But what you're seeing are hundreds of copper plates. So that's the dark metal that you see all along the interior here. That's her skin. And those copper plates were all riveted together with thousands of little copper rivets. But the copper skin has to be held up. So we can see there are thousands of steel bars connect the copper plates to the secondary iron bars. And all of those iron bars connect back here to these iron pylons.
The iron structure designed by Eiffel's engineers accommodates this staircase up to Miss Liberty's crown and its unique view of New York.
This view became popular over time, and as visitors keep coming to the Statue of Liberty, the Statue of Liberty becomes the Statue of Liberty. She becomes an icon that represents not just New York City, but the United States herself.
Thanks to its impressive structure, the Statue of Liberty has withstood the test of time. Since its inauguration in 1886, it has given New York a unique identity. Its universal appeal reflected on Gustav Eiffel. But despite this resounding success, his project for the 300-meter Paris Tower had stalled for lack of a firm government commitment. Fortunately, Gustav Eiffel was a shrewd businessman, winning orders in South America, Portugal, the Philippines, and the French colonies of Indochina.
Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam.
The Eiffel Company could afford to wait out the bureaucratic delays of the French government. It is in Vietnam that Eiffel built the greatest number of structures. The Pont de Messagerie in Ho Chi Minh City is well known. But dozens of portable bridges exported by Eiffel to Vietnam are now lost. The old city once boasted 100 of them.
A speedboat journey in sunshine. Here we are on a main canal which sort of circles round the south part of the city. A Vietnamese man says, "So you have a main canal and then smaller ones that cross it left and right. You find this grid all over the city."
The Vietnam War and rampant urbanization have probably destroyed most of Eiffel's portable bridges. But after studying satellite images of the city, Bertrand Lemoine is convinced that some of them might still be in use.
His guide says, "Here it is. I'm not sure if it's an Eiffel Bridge or not." Bertrand replies, "That's exactly why I wanted to see it. Because when I looked at maps and aerial photos in Paris, I said to myself that it looked like an Eiffel Bridge." Bertrand's guide, journalist Vo Trung Dung. "This looks a bit like railway tracks." Bertrand Lemoine, engineer, architect and historian, replies, "Yes, these are very simple elements, metal angles, U-shaped and I-shaped beams. These basic parts of metal construction make it possible to build shapes with triangular bracing that make the bridge's structure really stiff. And it shows that it's a typical Eiffel Bridge, with five spans of around 24 meters each, so it's really fantastic to rediscover it here." They now travel by scooter.
Another bridge of the same type has been spotted.
Vo Trung Dung pulls over on his scooter, with Bertrand riding on the back. Rach Thom Bridge, Vietnam. This really is a beautiful example of a so-called Eiffel portable bridge. Portable because you could bring over the prefabricated elements, parts which had been mounted with angle irons and rivets in Paris, and they could just be assembled with bolts on the spot to build the bridge. So here we can observe this sort of giant Meccano, and this one, the Rach Thom Bridge, is still here 140 years later. Bertrand continues, "Eiffel developed the invention of portable bridges at around the same time he designed the Eiffel Tower. Now they were much simpler to build than the Eiffel Tower, but were sold basically for the same price. This was a real cash cow for the company, since he was able to sell his bridges for export pretty much all around the world. So, a simple invention, but one that in fact proved extremely lucrative. On the timeline, 1887.
Back in Paris, Gustave Eiffel could count on the unfailing support of the French Minister of Trade. Édouard Leroy had launched a competition inviting submissions for the 1889 World's Fair. Among other projects, contestants shall study the possibility of erecting an iron tower on the Champ de Mars. It so happened that the specified dimensions were exactly those of Eiffel's design. Candidates only had 15 days to submit their designs.
Michel Carmener. Of course, the competition was attacked by parts of the press as fake after Mr. Leroy unsurprisingly chose the Eiffel Tower, although 107 projects had been submitted. But the main aim of the competition was, of course, to be able to announce that the winner for the tower project was Mr. Gustave Eiffel.
After months of struggle, Eiffel had won. He would have his tower, and he would finance it himself.
Eiffel initially proposed a 10-year concession to break even, and then cautiously pushed for 20 years, which is the duration that was accepted. So the tower was built to stand for 20 years, after which time it was due to be dismantled. Twenty-six months before inauguration.
At the company's headquarters in Levallois-Perret, engineers and draftsmen feverishly started work. The World's Fair would open on the 6th of May, 1889, giving them 2 years and 2 months to build the tower. The countdown had begun. Every part of the tower was calculated to 1/10 of a millimeter. More than 5,000 drawings were produced by this office. 7,300 tons of iron were ordered, and barely 20 days after the concession was signed, on the 27th of January, 1887, the first earthworks began on the vast, cleared expanse of the Champ de Mars. Using shovels and pickaxes, 400 workers labored for 9 hours a day to dig four huge holes. Rubble was disposed of in wheelbarrows, horse-drawn carts, and mine carts. The four legs of the tower had to be anchored deep in the ground. 31,000 cubic meters of earth, a volume equivalent to 10 Olympic-sized swimming pools, were removed using rudimentary methods. This stage of the works was essential to ensure the stability of the tower.
Bertrand, the structure of the Eiffel Tower itself weighs around 7,500 tons, a little more with the lifts and the other additions. It's not very heavy, but still it has to rest on what is called solid ground, that is to say, ground stable enough to receive its weight. Hence the need to dig 10, 15, even 20 meters underground to reach the very stable gravel bed on which to lay the masonry foundation.
The first problem came 2 weeks after work started. Well-known artists published a petition against the Eiffel Tower in the influential daily Le Temps under editor Adrien Hébrard. They protested against the erection of the useless and monstrous Eiffel Tower.
Que fait Hébrard?
Michel Carmener. How did Hébrard handle it? He passed on the petition to Minister Leroy and to Eiffel, and asked them both to write their response, which he would publish alongside the protest.
Eiffel's counterattack was scathing and inspired. Because we are engineers, do people think that we are not preoccupied by beauty in our constructions? And that although we build them sturdy and durable, we do not also strive to make them elegant? On site, the works were underway. The foundations on the banks of the Seine lay 7 meters below river level, so could easily flood. How would Eiffel overcome this obstacle?
On the timeline, 1858. Bordeaux, France.
He called on the know-how he'd acquired 30 years earlier in Bordeaux, when, as a young engineer, fresh out of the École Centrale, an elite engineering school, he led the construction of his first major iron structure, a 504-metre-long railway viaduct linking the two banks of the River Garonne, which is very wide at that point.
The bridge resembles a long square metal tunnel of girders supported on piers.
This impressive structure almost disappeared when the modern bridge rendered it obsolete. Gustave Eiffel's descendant, Myriam Lanaudy Eiffel, helped save this iron masterpiece.
Brown-haired Myriam has been lifted in a cherry picker. She now strolls along a walkway across the grey bridge. Unbelievable, really magnificent, she says.
It's the longest iron bridge ever built in France and still makes the Eiffel family proud.
Photographs during its construction. For the young Gustave Eiffel, this bridge was the chance of a lifetime. It had to be completed very quickly. He knew he was in competition with another engineer who was building a bridge in Strasbourg. He had to work better, faster and cheaper. In the beginning, Eiffel fell slightly behind and decided to standardize his parts. In the end, he finished first, in 2 years, at a lower cost, 3 million francs. He won by making a resolutely modern bridge.
Eiffel's youthful leadership skills helped solve this major technical challenge, digging riverbed foundations for the 6 pairs of bridge piers. How could anyone build such massive foundations 10 meters underwater?
Bertrand Lemoine. Eiffel implemented a technique he had discovered while working with his first boss, Charles Neveu. It involves driving large cast iron tubes, 3.6 meters in diameter, vertically into the river. The lower part rests on the riverbed while the upper part is in the open air. These casings are divided into 3 compartments. At the bottom, a pressurized chamber constantly supplied with compressed air to expel water seepage, where workers can work on a dry floor. In the middle, a decompression chamber, and at the top, an open air section from which rubble can be removed. This innovative compressed air technique was to prove decisive in the construction of the Eiffel Tower's foundations.
But when the compressed air chambers were used 30 years later to dig the tower's foundations near the Seine, workers in the pressurized section experienced problems.
Florence Alleron. As soon as pressurized casings came into use, workers developed an unknown sickness with tingling sensations, bleeding, breathing difficulties, partial paralysis of the limbs. Nobody understood the cause of this ailment, nor the importance of making decompression stops as workers came back up to the surface.
Press reports led to a public outcry, and once again, Eiffel relied on Minister Lecroix to subdue this new protest. He summoned the press to the construction site.
In April 1887, the Minister of Commerce decided to go down into the foundations himself and came back up alive.
Work resumed immediately. Soon, solid foundations were ready to support the metal structure.
Animation of an iron beam.
The iron elements were cut, trimmed, adjusted and drilled to the exact measurements set out in the plans. Once on site, they had to fit together perfectly. The Eiffel construction method made it possible to build at an amazing pace.
A riveted iron section is painted red, then is hoisted on site.
6 months after the start of construction, 4 54-degree inclined pillars rose from the ground. There were very few workers on site, barely 250, but they were very efficient.
The workers started their day at 6 a.m. In winter, they worked 9-hour days, in summer, 12-hour days, often in harsh conditions. They were paid almost twice as much as workers on other Parisian construction sites of the same period. Construction photographs.
Progress was impressive. The metallic structure rising fast to the incessant beat of the riveters' hammers. But how were the parts assembled on the building site? In Gonesse, north of Paris, one business still employs the efficient riveting assembly process used by the Eiffel Company.
General Metal Edition, Gonesse, France.
In this workshop, Eiffel-style beams are produced to restore old structures.
Okay.
A small furnace is opened, and a worker wearing thick gloves takes out a white-hot rivet with metal tongs. He hits the rivet before slotting it through holes joining metal sections. A pneumatic machine held on the other side then compresses the hot rivet to fix it in place.
At the time of the tower's construction, there were no pneumatic tools. Riveting was carried out on site by teams of four workers. The first makes the rivet white hot in a brazier. The second positions it in the assembly hole. The third holds the rivet head while the fourth hammers it in place. As it cools, the rivet contracts, holding the parts firmly together. A total of 2.5 million rivets were set on the Eiffel Tower, half of them on site, sometimes in highly acrobatic and even dangerous conditions. No lives were lost during the main construction phase of the project, but one Italian worker, Angelo Scagliotti, died shortly after the tower's inauguration. As the structure grew, so did the challenges. How do you lift thousands of tons of iron to heights of 100, 200, and then 300 meters? Eiffel came up with a solution using mobile steam cranes in each of the tower's legs. The greatest challenge facing the engineers was securing horizontal beams to the four inclined legs to create a first floor platform.
Computer animation.
The position of the four 700-ton pillars had to be millimeter perfect.
Two devices were used by Eiffel, sandboxes, an ancient technique already used by the Egyptians, and hydraulic jacks placed at the base of the pillars. Two of the pillars were fitted with 800-ton hydraulic jacks so as to be able to raise the crossbeams slightly and make up for any possible misalignment when they came together. In addition, sandboxes were placed between the scaffolding and the crossbeams. To tilt one of the crossbeams, you simply opened the box and emptied the sand inside. The combination of sandboxes and hydraulic jacks enabled the rivet holes previously drilled in the beams and crossbeams to be precisely adjusted, thus facilitating the assembly of the first level.
Du premier étage.
14 months before inauguration, an animation shows a worker lying high up across a red-painted iron beam holding a rivet in place.
The tower was standing by itself. They had done it. To Eiffel's great relief, the complex operation was complete.
Onlookers look up at the first completed level as hats are thrown into the air. Computer-animated snowfall over a photograph.
But January 1888 was a hard month. Winter slowed down their progress, and the second and third levels were still to be built. Another 250 meters were required to reach the magical 300-meter height. With only 15 months left, time was running out. That same year, Another ambitious engineering project was making headlines in Paris. There was bad news from Panama, where French entrepreneur Ferdinand de Lesseps was digging a canal without locks to connect the Atlantic and Pacific oceans. Disaster upon disaster had left it considerably behind schedule.
Michel Carmener, Gustave Eiffel biographer. Eiffel had long wanted revenge for the way he had been insulted by Ferdinand de Lesseps when the Panama Canal was being designed. Lesseps had organized a meeting of experts and rigged it to have the vast majority of them assert that a single-level canal was favorable. Eiffel, for his part, with a very small number of other experts, claimed that it was impossible and that a lock canal would be needed. Photos show railway lines for the canal's construction. Darcy Grimaldo Grigsby.
The Panama Canal, organized by Lesseps, who again, I emphasize, was not an engineer, was such a failure and entailed such loss of life. And as people, you know, it entailed trying to cut through a mountain. And that mountain kept having mudslides. It was a disaster.
Finally, and 1 billion gold francs later, the Lesseps version of the canal without locks had to be abandoned. And the Panama Interoceanic Company, the pride of France, funded by thousands of small investors, had to be salvaged. Many saw Eiffel as the man to turn this disaster into a triumph. Boosted by progress on the tower, Eiffel agreed to take on the most gigantic civil engineering project of his times. For the astronomical amount of 100 million francs, more than 15 times the Eiffel Tower's construction cost, he was contracted to build 10 giant canal locks.
He agrees to make those locks at a great cost to Lesseps. Eiffel will reap great rewards, and he needs those, I believe, to build the Eiffel Tower. I believe that the Panama Canal project is partly funding the Eiffel Tower itself.
Eiffel had to take charge of the construction site, direct the gigantic earthworks, manufacture 20 enormous lock gates of his own design, then ship them to Panama and deliver the work all before the concession expired in 1890. He now had two races against the clock.
The contract with the Panama Canal Company was for 100 million francs. Now, out of this 100 million, Eiffel effectively received 73 million. This was calculated by the accounting experts at the time. There were audits. 10 months before inauguration, a lattice of animated metal beams.
The Eiffel Company was working at full capacity. On the 4th of July, 1888, a party was in full swing on the tower's first level. Gustav Eiffel had organized a banquet to celebrate American Independence Day. The first level of the tower was decked out in the colors of the two nations. In the middle, a table had been set up to welcome the press. Over 40 journalists and foreign correspondents had made the ascent to the first floor.
1888, September 19.
But 6 months before the scheduled completion date, the site's machinery ground to a halt. On the 19th of September, 1888, most of the workers went on strike.
First of all, they had a very hot summer, and they had to work ever higher up. To this argument about the hazards of the construction work, Eiffel responded that there was no more danger at 300 meters than at 40. He asked his workers to resume work, adding that they would be laid off if they did not turn up the very next morning. Photographs of workers on the structure.
Of the 140 riveters, fitters, and carpenters, only 27 showed up for work. Construction couldn't continue. Eiffel quickly did the calculations. The tower might not be completed in time for the World's Fair. He met their demands. By November 1888, Eiffel and his team were all smiles again. The tower had become the tallest building on Earth, 170 meters, 1 meter higher than the Washington Monument's stone obelisk. Progress would now be faster. The structure was thinner and required fewer parts. 1 meter was being added every day. By the 15th of March, 1889, the third level was almost complete. But there was still the paintwork to finish and the lifts to install, which was turning into a major headache. The tower's lifts, a crucial part of the visitor experience, represented a technological leap forward. Transporting the public to a height of 300 meters was a new challenge, and new machinery had to be invented to meet it. Stéphane Rozec is in charge of the lifts. His workplace is worthy of a novel by Jules Verne. The key to producing the energy needed to raise the lifts to the first and then the second level is hydraulic pressure.
Already in 1889, it was water under pressure that was used to move the lifts. The vertical cylinder is the lift's counterweight. Inside the rod is water. Outside, in the yellow part, are 180 tons of pig iron. And all this weight will apply a force generating a 42 bar pressure on the water.
This hydraulic pressure pushes an imposing 16-meter-long jack. In turn, it drives a rail-mounted carriage, which operates a set of pulleys that raises the elevated car up to the second level. When the piston travels 1 meter, this system of pulley cables moves the cabin 8 meters. But on the 31st of March, 1889, the lifts were not ready, and Gustave Eiffel had to climb the stairs to raise the French flag.
1 month before inauguration, animation shows Eiffel at the small domed pinnacle.
A few daring climbers brave the heights to accompany him.
A large tricolor flies from a small mast at the top of the tower.
This beautiful open structure had been completed in record time. Well, almost. The lifts were not yet working, and the paintwork was unfinished.
Archive film shows workers painting the structure with brushes and without safety harnesses.
The Eiffel Tower has received 19 coats of paint since its construction, an average of one every 7 years, as prescribed by Gustav Eiffel himself, to protect it from rust. From one painting campaign to the next, the tower's colours have changed. Very bright at the time of the World's Fair, they have since become much darker.
Pierre-Antoine Gattier. What impresses me most is this totally overwhelming idea that not only the Eiffel Tower is coloured, but that there is a colour gradient. The base of the tower is dark, the top of the tower is pale. The sandy brown tower looming against the blue sky today.
The tower has been repainted 19 times. It is now time for a fresh coat. Pierre-Antoine Gattier is in charge.
The 20th painting campaign is exceptional because, first, it respects Gustave Eiffel's wish to paint the tower every 7 years.
d'une peinture tous les 7 ans.
But what is new in this campaign is that we have been able to change the color. We were able to revert to the colors intended by Gustav Eiffel.
The yellow-brown paint is the same color chosen by Eiffel in 1907, when the tower acquired permanent status.
A man climbs on the tower with a paint can hanging from his hip. His brush resembles an old-fashioned shaving brush.
The tower is repainted by rope access, using tools such as the mop, an angled brush similar to those originally used by the Eiffel Company workers.
We apply paint which is specially mixed for the Eiffel Tower. It's slightly liquid so that it gets into the cracks, and we use this type of mop which allows us to apply the paint well and get into the corners.
It takes several years to apply the 60 tons of paint to cover the surface of the tower using this technique.
A man in a hard hat on a harness leans out as he works high up. 1889, May 6.
In Paris, after more than 2 years of dizzying construction work, the big day arrived. Parisians and visitors flocked into the city. On the 6th of May, 1889, after a race against the clock, the French president, Sadi Carnot, opened the World's Fair with the utmost solemnity. The triumph of iron was complete. The World's Fair was then open to the public, who arrived in droves, thanks in part to a railway line specially built for the occasion. Contrary to some of the artists' predictions, the sight was priceless.
Photos show views high over Paris. Florence Alleron, curator, Cité de l'Architecture et du Patrimoine. Right from its inauguration, foreigners flocked to the tower. And the English, as well as the Americans, and even the Germans, the sworn enemies of France, and who until then had scorned the project, all were bowled over by the grandeur of this tower. The Red Tower lit up after dark in animation.
On the evening of the 6th of May, 1889, there was a grand celebration. And the tower unveiled her lights for the first time. Boats on the Seine were festooned with lanterns. Orchestras played late into the night. The special day of inauguration ended with a suitably festive climax.
Fireworks, rising up the tower in daylight.
The Universal Expo World's Fair was a huge success, attracting 32 million visitors between May and October 1889. Over the same period of time, Monsieur Eiffel's tower, the undisputed star of the fair, sold over 2 million tickets, a resounding success.
Michel Carmener, the Eiffel Tower raised 6 million francs in ticket sales just during the period of the 1889 World's Fair. This was a little over Eiffel's expectations, so it was a business success as well. A sepia photo of bearded, somber Eiffel.
But despite Eiffel's star shining so brightly, the year 1892 turned into a nightmare. He was caught up in an enormous scandal that shook French society. The bankruptcy of the company that built the Panama Canal, headed by the famous Charles de Lesseps. Thousands of small investors were ruined. Some committed suicide. The scandal revealed the corruption of members of parliament from every party. Eiffel, too, was a suspect.
He was accused of being a shadow director, of having behaved as if he were an administrator of the Panama Canal Company. Naturally, he defended himself. He had never been an administrator, but because of the huge task he was entrusted with, he was viewed as the true boss, you could say, of the company.
Manitou, si je peux dire, de la compagnie du canal.
On the timeline, 1893, January 10.
On the 10th of January, after a two-year investigation, the trial of the directors of the Panama Interoceanic Company opened in Paris. Facing the judges at the higher appeals court, the defendants include Charles de Lesseps, along with his father Ferdinand de Lesseps, two other company directors, and Eiffel. They had to answer charges of complicity and fraud and breach of trust. At first, Eiffel was convinced he would be exonerated. But a month later, although defended by a brilliant lawyer, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison and fined 20,000 francs. He was discredited and his reputation shattered. For Eiffel, it was a humiliation.
L'affaire de Panama est une véritable césure.
Miriam Lonaudi Eiffel. The Panama Canal scandal was a real rupture in both his life and his career. It caused him shame, suffering, and put him in jeopardy. So it was a really painful period for him.
Une période très douloureuse pour lui.
The tower was also going through a rough patch. Visitors were deserting it, and the scandal didn't help. What would become of the monument as the date approached for the World's Fair in 1900, also taking place in Paris? Transformation projects emerged, maliciously proposing to turn the tower into an improbable rock, or a giant belfry topped by a clock, or a kind of Mesopotamian ziggurat. Eiffel dismissed these projects as distortions of his tower. What he really wanted was to transform it into a palace of electricity. The investment would have been enormous, but the tower would essentially be preserved in its original form.
1900, April, flickering archive film.
The 1900 fair was much larger than that of 1889, and its center was no longer on the Champ de Mars, but closer to Les Invalides and the Place de la Concorde, where a spectacular gateway had been placed.
Huge and arched.
As a result, the tower found itself on the sidelines, and the modernization work carried out to improve the lifts and install electricity was not enough to rekindle public interest.
In 1900, the most attractive monuments for the public were the Palace of Electricity, the Grand Palais, home to the fine arts, and the Petit Palais, home to French art. These were all characterized by the return of stone, so the tower had an almost anachronistic feel in 1900.
Once the 1900 World's Fair was over, ideas emerged to transform the Champ de Mars again, this time into a large park. Eiffel was worried. He looked for ways to preserve the tower and make it a lasting fixture in the Parisian landscape. It would be the last battle of his life. With his mind increasingly focused on science, he foresaw the importance of wireless radio, which required very high antennas. He understood the role the tower could play in the development of wireless telegraphy. In December 1903, he decided to turn to the army. His proposal received a cool reception at the ministry, except from a brilliant young engineer, Captain Ferrier, who was looking to develop wireless telegraphy. Ferrier obtained authorization from the army to install a wireless station at the Eiffel Tower. Gustave Eiffel paid for huts to host a transmitter on the Champ de Mars. The tower was equipped with an extraordinary antenna made of four steel cables. This antenna was constantly evolving. The Iron Lady ended up being rigged with 360-meter cables. 1 year before its concession was due to end in 1909, it had become a strategic tool for national defense. The tower was saved from destruction and the concession was extended.
1923, December 27.
It was a cold day in Paris when Gustave Eiffel died on the 27th of December 1923 at the age of 91, 1 year after the inauguration of Radio Tour Eiffel. Le Matin paid him tribute. A great Frenchman whose name is famous the world over has just died. Gustave had left his tower without a protector. A few years later, the Eiffel Tower lost its 41-year record as the world's tallest building. In quick succession, two New York skyscrapers overtook it. The Chrysler Building at 319 meters in 1930, followed by the famous Empire State Building in 1931, which topped out at 381 meters.
The Eiffel Tower in so many ways is surpassed by skyscrapers, the building of taller and taller structures, especially in the United States. And I think there's a way that in terms of appreciating its longevity, one has to understand that what began as unforeseen modern construction, so bold, so geometric, so non-figurative, at some point transforms into a certain quaintness, a certain nostalgia for a 19th century that has been so surpassed by the 20th. The Eiffel Tower still stands not just for Paris, but for 19th century Paris.
Tower floodlights come on today.
Now in the hands of the city of Paris, this 19th century monument renews itself constantly to retain its glamour. In 1985, 336 sodium lamps were installed inside the structure. Then a network of LED bulbs was added all over the outer surface to create a sparkling effect that has delighted visitors since the turn of the millennium.
A beam of light shines from the top.
Its nocturnal aura has been further enhanced in the early 21st century by the installation of a new beacon that casts a spectacular beam through the Parisian night sky. This powerful spotlight no longer signals the tower to aircraft, since the Paris skies have been closed to them. It now shines out over the French capital and its suburbs for the pleasure of all.
The spotlight sweeps round the illuminated Eiffel Tower.
For over 30 years, the brilliant Gustave Eiffel and his eccentric Iron Lady went through uncertain times. But together, they worked wonders and have made Paris a magnet for travelers from all over the world. During World War I, wireless telegraphy saved France from defeat by thwarting German attacks. Nowadays, nothing is too daring for it to please the crowds on special popular celebrations like Bastille Day. A visionary work and the adventure of a lifetime for its creator, the Eiffel Tower has never ceased to reinvent itself.
Colorful, dramatic fireworks explode all around the tower. Speeded up clouds rush past the tower in time-lapse film.